Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we are spending this portion of W and the name of Raina Andrews. She is based in Milwaukee, and she calls herself a public health ambassador. And in particular, she is really serious about us getting serious about food and eating good, healthy food. And we're going to find out about some of the ways in which she works on this laudable goal. One of the ways is by writing a really delightful children's book that we're going to be talking about, titled Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale. And we'll be talking about that book as well. Also with us in the studio is someone whose name will be familiar particularly to Kenosha listeners, or some Kenosha listeners at least, Dr. Howard Moon, who for many years was part of the administration of the Kenosha Unified School District. His last position with them was Director of Language Arts, Social Studies, Foreign Language, and Reading. And it was actually at the suggestion of Howard Moon that I extended this invitation to Raina Andrews to join us. And Dr. Moon is in the studio with us as well to kind of talk about his initial encounter with Raina Andrews. And so I'm really happy to have both of these guests with me in the WGTD studios this afternoon. So Raina Andrews and Howard Brown, Howard Moon. Let me say that again. Snip that out. Raina Andrews and Howard Moon, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And don't snip out the Howard Brown part, because he and I exchanged frivolity. He would call me O.H.
Ah.
And then he would say, the other Howard. And then he would nod his head knowingly and say, and by far the better Howard.
Oh, that sounds exactly like something Howard Brown would say.
Yes,
so, all right, at your insistence, I'll leave in my mistake.
By all means.
Good to have both of you here. So, Howard Moon, I want to start with you because this was your idea for me to invite Raina Andrews onto the morning show. I'd like you to explain to our listeners how you first met her and first heard her speak.
Yes, my pleasure, Greg, and thank you for inviting me, and Raina, of course. Raina joined a team of seven Rotarians earlier this summer on an exchange program in the Bahamas. And the part that got my attention first was each of us had to submit a brief biography just for their information, inviting us to their initial meeting, greeting us as exchange. Raina's biography was picked out, and she was solicited to make remarks to the Bahama Rotarians. I was not selected for that purpose either. And so certainly that got my attention. And in fact, it was at that first Rotarian meeting where Raina spoke perhaps for 20 minutes without notes and had the audience there spellbound with the topic that she was addressing. And it certainly got my attention because I like very articulate people and very committed people to whatever their task is. And then in the process of getting acquainted, I found that she had authored this book of which she had a copy because, there again, she was invited to a school in the Bahamas to speak to third or fourth grade students and present this book to them. And as an educator, I was deeply impressed by the fact that when you talk to anybody, whether it's teachers or students, it's a pretty good signal if a question is asked and three-fourths of the hands go up in response to the question.
Yeah.
So that certainly got my attention. And then upon our return, I was able to show this to some of the staff members, and immediately, that was before school's out, the principal, Jody Cascio at Forest Park, invited her because there was a switched appointment or something to, in fact, speak to the children in Forest Park about this book, present it as an author and then almost as a teacher. Same thing happened. Three-fourths of the kids raised their hands enthusiastically at every question she brought about. Hmm. And so I think it's important because of the topic of hunger and Tale of the Mysterious Kale. Kale, it was mysterious to me because I virtually never heard of kale before, but now I know more than maybe I want.
Right.
of that. But so I'm very glad that you accepted the prospect of having Raina talk to you on the radio. So that's my introduction.
Very good. And that's a great story in and of itself. Let me just so I understand. So a number of Rotarians, members of the Rotary Club up in this neck of the woods,
yes,
went down to the Bahamas.
Yes.
And some people from the Bahamas and the Rotary Club came up here? Was it that kind of exchange?
Well, not that club, but they're planning to, because we struck a wonderful relationship with them, and we were deeply, deeply impressed with how committed they are to the Rotary Club in the Bahamas.
Wow.
And so that was good on both sides, I think. So, no, we were just volunteers, really, from our various Rotary Clubs. I'm from the Kenosha Rotary Club, and Raina was from the
Mequon Walk After Hours, yeah.
Okay. And Lake Geneva was represented, so there were seven of us.
Very good. Well, what a great trip, and that is a nice introduction indeed to our conversation with Raina Andrews. So, Raina, ahead of us talking about specifically this book and what you are doing now, let's first find out a little bit about you, where you are from originally, and maybe at least something of your life's journey that takes you to where you are now and to what you're doing now.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Greg, and thank you so much for that warm introduction, Howard. I so appreciate you. So I'm originally a transplant to Wisconsin. I'm from Houston, Texas, by way of New Orleans. And as a result of Hurricane Katrina that hit in 2005, I was displaced to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, out of all places. And that's a story in itself on how I got to Oshkosh. But I've worked in higher education. I've worked in government affairs for nearly a decade before moving to Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, a nonprofit. And Feeding America, you know, decided that we want to move from feeding the hungry to solving hunger. And to me, that meant that they were putting a stake in the ground and saying, you know what, together we will solve hunger, and this is the blueprint for doing it. So they hired me to really evangelize what that blueprint looked like in the community. And so as I was doing community engagement and outreach with adults, I saw that it was very difficult for you to lead adults to food. It was very even more difficult to get them to eat the healthier options. And so this was around the time in Milwaukee where there was lead in the water system, and I was trying to get adults to eat dark leafy vegetables, and I saw that they were very resistant to it. Spinach, kale, broccoli, bok choy, what's that? And so I figured, let me put a spin on this, and let me see if I can get children excited about it. So I would go to local area food pantries, boys and girls clubs, and start just telling story to kids. And then one night, I dreamt of Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale. It wasn't called that at the time, but the concept was born, and I decided to put it in a children's book. And when I published this last year and I started reading it to children, I realized the exact same response that Howard described. It became magnetic. Like, the students began to see themselves in Alex McGreen and to cause their own healthy food movement. And so as a result of this book, I did create an organization. I'm the founder of the Healthy Food Movement, which reconnects young people to the source of their food. We're used to food coming in plastic bags or cardboard boxes, but that's not real food. And so getting people to have an intimate exchange with their food is what this whole movement is all about.
Interesting. Do you have any background yourself as a dietitian or any kind of personal history that would suggest that this was going to be part of your future?
Absolutely not. I mean, to the extent my grandmother was a dietitian, but she would always tell me, it wasn't to this extent. I had to take on my own personal health and well-being myself. Back in 2016, I did a TEDx at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and my TEDx was on food insecurity as a public health concern. And I described everything that was happening in our food system from and in the nonprofit network and how it was important for us all to work together rather in silos. But if you know anything about TEDx's, that 18-minute kind of monologue that you present on a bright idea, it was 9 weeks to procure that and to really dig into what is my food story. And it was in that that I realized that as a young child, I'd experienced food insecurity myself. It was kind of like a secret, a nasty little secret that I tucked in the back. But that emerged as I was preparing for my talk that food insecurity is a public health concern. And that's where I became a staunch advocate for communities in need, for communities that are experiencing food deserts and our extreme food waste in our communities.
Hmm. Can you tell us more about that term food insecurity? That's not a term I have heard before. Or I don't think I have anyway. What's behind that?
Absolutely. So food insecurity is often used synonymously with hunger. And they're very different. Food insecurity is a term coined by the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, and it describes over a 12-month period if a family, A, has not had enough food to eat within the last 12 months, and B, if could they afford the food that they ate in the last 12 months. And so it's a spectrum on the degree of hunger. So it's kind of like you're kind of food insecure to extremely food insecure, where you had to go to food pantries or there were nights where your family didn't have any food at all. And so when we describe hunger, that happens more at the personal level. Food insecurity happens at the household level.
Ah, mm-hmm. And it is a spectrum.
Correct.
In other words, there are different degrees of severity that we are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose one end of that spectrum also might be a household where nobody is literally going hungry, but on the other hand, choices are being made in terms of what is purchased, what is eaten, not according to how healthy it is, but rather that this is the food we can afford to purchase.
If food insecurity isn't on your kitchen table, it's certainly in your backyard. There are 51 million Americans that are below the poverty line, which is $25,000 a year. And in Wisconsin, it's 1 in 7. And in my community, where their children are present, it's 1 in 4 households. That's like 1, 2, 3. And if there's a phantom person in here, it'll be 4. And so for me, this is alarming because it affects violence, it affects education, it affects our entire ecosystem. So back in 2016, when I was talking about food insecurity as a public health concern, the fact that one person is hungry, the community should be outraged. But it's almost as if we become desensitized to it.
Right. There's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And often it's also, I suppose, one of those problems that isn't immediately visible to the eye. I mean, most of us don't see what happens within the four walls of other people's homes and apartments. And
mm-hmm.
so we aren't really in a position to know just how serious this is. So, for instance, what drew you to this issue apparently was your growing awareness of just how widespread this problem was. I mean, what are we talking about in terms of its severity?
So what really attracted me to this is that not only is this a severe problem, but we have all the resources and tools now to really close the meal gap. So in Wisconsin, you have over 700,000 people that are hungry. And you probably have more like 140,000 that are on the brink of being hungry, where there may be a paycheck or sick day away from being food insecure. And the reason why I say that we can close that meal gap is that 1.1 billion pounds of food goes to waste each year. And I'm not talking about, you know, scraps off the table. I'm talking about really good canned goods from manufacturers that have maybe a 0.2% more salt or sodium than what the recipe calls for. They'll throw it into the landfill. Or because we're used to this grade A product in the grocery store, they will throw it out because consumers don't like ugly produce. But you've probably heard of the ugly produce movement happening.
Yes, yes.
And so thank goodness for movements like that, or like Gooder, which allows for restaurants to have their excess food due to the Good Samaritan laws be given to food pantries or hot meal programs or shelters to repurpose for meals. So what we're talking about is really good food that's being diverted from the landfill onto our kitchen tables.
Mm. So we're actually talking about a couple of different things here. We're talking about people who, for whatever reason, are hungry. And we're also talking about too many people not eating healthy enough, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's both of those things, and they aren't exactly the same thing, but they are closely related. I mean, some people don't eat good food just sort of out of a simple and maybe largely ignorant choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because they can't afford fresh produce and other fine foods, but that's just what they gravitate to for whatever reason.
It's easy. It's convenience food. And so what we see is that what the data will show us are that populations who are experiencing extreme poverty or in scenarios of food insecurity, they cannot afford the food that they put on their table. So it becomes almost like a food justice issue. And so what we find is that populations who are experiencing poverty are less healthier. It's almost like this continuum, right? You need food, health, housing, and employment on spokes on a wheel for your car to function. And if one of those things are missing, such as healthy and nutritious food, it's likely that you'll have health disparities. If you have health disparities, it's likely you can't keep a job. If you can't keep a job, et cetera, et cetera. And so I look at it as a continuum, the systems work. And when you talk about it from a public health lens, is that you can't just look at pounds in and pounds out of a household. You have to look at the quality of foods that people are consuming in their body. Because if, you know, on the corners, if you count the corner store as a grocery store and all they can get are honey buns, chocolate milk, and Flamin' Hots, that's not going to carry the day.
Right.
And that's the food that people have been accessing.
Right. So if you live someplace where there is not a full-service grocery store, then chances are you have a very narrow range of choices of food to buy for tonight's dinner.
Yes. And so what I'm out to do through the healthy food movement and through our food literacy initiatives is to change the narrative and re-educate communities on how healthy food can be fast food and how healthy food can taste really good and that it doesn't have to come in a cardboard box that you stick in a microwave to feed your family, that fresh produce can go a very long way.
So are you aiming your efforts towards a certain socioeconomic class, or is some of this message intended for anyone and everyone?
This message is accessible for everyone. And really my target market are third graders. Because oftentimes third graders don't see themselves as being a voice, as a change agent in the household. But through our exercises where I read the book, we do some engagement, they do some internal discovery, they find that they do have a voice to make suggestions and to have powerful change in the household.
You said earlier in the interview something about how you find it difficult to draw adults to food or something like that? Is that, am I quoting you correctly?
Absolutely, Greg.
Explain what you mean by those kind of interesting words.
So through Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, I was participating in a number of health fairs around the time that the whole lead epidemic was announced in Milwaukee, and that's still continuing. And at these health fairs, I'd bring bundles of kale and spinach and really beautiful fresh produce that you'd find at a farmer's market. But what we were seeing is that adults would not take the unfamiliar things. They'd take apples and oranges, but anything green they'd stay away from. And so I started doing cooking demonstrations on this is how you can prepare it, and it's just so good. Try this asparagus. Try this bok choy. And one, they weren't familiar with it, and two, they weren't willing to try it. It's almost like adults have this fixed way of being. Like when I asked Howard, it's like, do you want to try this kale? He's like, what is this? I don't want this. No. And I mean, he'll try it now, but that's just really the way that adults are. However, children, I found, are much more open, especially if you make it fun. Make it almost like an exploration, like exploratory learning. And so I'd make kale smoothies, kale cookies, kale chips, and they go kale crazy over it. And what used to be a very strange vegetable now becomes a regular part of their vocabulary and their diet.
Interesting. I think Dr. Moon and I are similar in that when we were growing up, I never heard of kale. I mean, as far as I know, it didn't even exist, and I'm sure it did, but it was not a part of everyday vocabulary the way, at least to some extent, that it is now. I mean, is it a relatively sort of new player in the kind of the food landscape of America?
Only to advertising. Kale has been around for so long, and I mean, you know, Popeye is the one who made spinach popular, and so I guess now kale is the new wave.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Raina Andrews, and we are going to be talking in a moment about a children's book that she has written called Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale. Raina Andrews works tirelessly on this issue of healthy eating, healthy living, and this is what brings her here to the morning show. And this invitation was extended at the suggestion of Howard Moon, who's also with us in the studios today. So let's talk for a moment about kale itself. What is kale exactly? I mean, is it related to spinach? Is it part of the spinach family, so to speak?
Absolutely. They're in the same family, and they provide much of the same nutrients. I think the hierarchy of super greens or superfood would be bok choy, kale, followed by spinach, and then Brussels sprouts. And the reason why I really push kale is that it being a superfood and a dark leafy vegetable, it helps to draw out the toxins in our body from our water to our soil that are that our produce or food is grown from. There are a lot of toxins and contaminants. And from the time that your food is farmed to the time that it gets to your dinner plate, your food is touched about 32 different times. And so it's important that you eat these dark leafy vegetables, preferably in the most raw form, to help provide roughage and to provide vitamin C and other minerals to your body to draw those toxins out. Kind of like charcoal will draw certain toxins out of your body. That's exactly what these dark leafy vegetables do to your insides.
Which is part of what your children's book is about. I think the only time I've had kale or knowingly had kale was actually when it was cooked. There's something at Panera, their quinoa lentil bowl with grilled chicken that I absolutely love. And one of the ingredients that's right in there is kale. And at least in that setting, I really like it a lot. Now, is raw kale more of an acquired taste? You kind of hinted at that in some of what you said.
Some people really don't like kale because it is more rough than a spinach.
In texture.
It can be more bitter, especially if you don't remove it from the rib, which is like the main stalk of the kale, and if you don't massage it to break down some of the bitterness. And so you would want to get a really good olive oil to massage to break down the bitterness and the elements of the kale and to make it more digestible, and add a little sea salt or some Himalayan pink sea salt, and it's just absolutely delicious. I'll eat it just like that.
Interesting. So chances are some people have formed their opinion about kale because they haven't done any of those fancy steps.
They usually just chop it up as you would any other vegetable, but there is a process to work it down to really bring out the nutrients and the flavor of kale.
Interesting. So that's in that respect, it's different from a carrot, for instance. I mean, you kind of pull up a carrot, you clean it off, and you're ready to go.
Yeah.
But yeah, so kale needs a little bit of help, but on the other hand, it sounds like nutritionally, it's very much worth it.
Yes, it is.
So tell our listeners about what happens to the character in your book, Alex McGreen. I have to say, when I opened up this book, I did not expect what I found on either the first or second page. I mean, it's not the kind of story that we typically see in a children's book.
Yes, I would say this is for the mature third grader. And so Alex McGreen is a 10-year-old girl who is sent home. How the book starts is that it's a 10-year-old girl in her science class. The whole school is sent home with notes to their parents saying that school is being closed because lead has been found in the water system. And so she has a kind of non-traditional home where the grandfather lives with her parents, and he welcomes her and says, "What's going on, Alex?" And she lets him know that lead is growing, and he informs her that his parents were sharecroppers and they grew their own food, and he experienced something like this, and so they're able to grow food and have other people be healthy. But when the grocery store was all out of kale, he had the idea of, well, let's grow our own food. As a matter of fact, I have this blueprint for a growing machine, and I've got this special elixir that can help expedite the growing process. So she and her grandfather develop a vertical garden in their basement to grow kale. But, you know, Alex is mischievous, and with a snafu with Grandpa's special elixir, overnight, voila, you've got a basement full of kale. So what do you do with a bunch of kale? You make kale cookies, kale chips, kale smoothies. She gives them to her classmates, and they go kale crazy, where they serve kale in the class, in the cafeteria. And that's how Alex is an example of starting her own healthy food movement.
Wow. It is a story charmingly told in the book. And by the way, Brian Bizdaka is responsible for the very imaginative illustrations. That's somebody that I know from my work at the Racine Theater Guild, and I didn't even realize he had this mm-hmm. gift besides being a fine actor and singer. So that was fun to see his name on the cover. So this is designed to get young children interested in this thing called kale, and it sounds like it works.
It does. Absolutely. When I do engagements at schools or Boys and Girls Clubs, I'll come in and I have a life-size figure of Alex McGreen so that young people can see themselves in it. Mm. But I also have, I bring real live foods and I do an exercise with children where I test them in the very beginning asking, where does your food come from? And so I have a student volunteer come up and we have slides on the screen. And so we ask, where do coconuts come from? Where do bananas come from? Where do apples? Because we usually see them in their final form in the grocery store. But it gets children to stand up and down and squat to show me physically where our food comes from. And we also are able to, I guide them through recipes on how to make kale smoothies, kale chips. And they absolutely love it. It's a new discovery for them.
Hmm. For someone who is not maybe quite ready to make kale chips and kale smoothies and kale cookies, who just wants to consume kale a little more simply, I mean, given what you were saying earlier about what makes sense, is kale something, for instance, that it makes sense to just eat on its own or to put in a salad or put on a sandwich? I mean, what are kind of the less fancy ways to use mm-hmm. kale?
So I'll tell you, the less fancy ways aren't really that sexy, okay? Mm-hmm. kale certainly has an acquiring taste, and I would recommend someone just try it in a kale salad. But certainly a salad with different fixings. Like I love having roasted pecans on the salad with maybe some craisins and just a really high quality extra virgin olive oil where you massage the bib with some avocado, maybe some fresh strawberries and light sea salt. And there you go. It's very delicious.
Do you think it makes sense to mix kale with, for instance, other kinds of lettuce or things that we are more familiar with? Or is it better to just, in a sense, have it more on its own with things added to it?
I like a mix. I love kale mixed with spring greens. I enjoy kale with arugula because they both have very distinct flavors and they make a delightful medley together.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, as you suggested earlier, I myself, who have just a growing sensitivity, now begin to notice it in actual menus. Kale as an ingredient is mentioned in sandwich makeups and salad makeups and other servings that I literally had never noticed before, or maybe it's coming into more prominent use. I don't know. Anyway, Raina's making a tremendous case here for reevaluation of our entire population, not just the needy, but the needless.
Right, yeah. All of us should be eating more kale.
Right.
Absolutely.
I'd like to add to that. And so the reason why this work is so important, that our next generation gets intimately connected to our food, is because of the number of children that have preventable dietary-related diseases. Like obesity, like one in two children, 50% of our population, are obese. That's alarming, which leads to heart disease, which leads to all types of other debilitating diseases. And it's all preventable. It's all connected to our diet. So if we can get our young people moving and excited and more conscious about the foods that they're putting in their mouth, I mean, just imagine the community that can be built from this.
Right. Let's talk about a vexing problem in all of this, namely, and you've touched on it already, the so-called food deserts. That is, people who live in places where it isn't an easy option at all to walk into a well-stocked supermarket and find things like kale, let alone fine virgin olive oil and so on. I mean, it's just not to be found anywhere in their neighborhood. That's a more complicated process, a problem that has a lot more to do than just people making careless choices. To what extent is this a problem that that your nonprofit is trying to engage with?
It's an extreme problem. You know, historically, I'm not the first one to create a healthy food movement. Healthy food movements have been around, really became popular in the 70s and 80s. And those are more of the healthy food movements of privilege, right? It's they talk about the quality of food and the types of grocery stores. I evangelize for the healthy food movement for the folks who don't even know that they're being disenfranchised by being in a food desert. And so this is almost like an awakening where I put myself in their shoes, where I'm doing next month during Hunger Action Month, I am doing an experiment called Dine on the Line, where for those who qualify for food stamps, the minimum amount that you get each month is $15. So for a week, I'll try and survive off of eating $15 worth of food. And so wish me good luck, right?
Wow.
But that's for me to put myself in another person's shoes, and they only have $15 to survive off of a month. Can you imagine that? And so going to the grocery store and looking for, what am I going to buy for $15? Because you have several people making decisions between rent and food, or prescription drugs and food, and baby formula and food. And I don't think people should be having to make such decisions.
Right, right. So those are big problems. I mean, beyond the scope of any one nonprofit organization. So what kind of advocacy work are you engaged in, or would you... What kind of advocacy work is necessary from others on this particular issue?
In this work, we say that we need food funds and friends, right? And so when people do food drives and donate to Feeding America, Eastern Wisconsin, or their local food pantries, they're doing a great service, because about 70% of the food that goes out to our more than 600 partners, which are food pantries, hot milk programs, and shelters, go directly back to the communities in which the food was donated from. We get a lot of food from retailers, wholesalers, manufacturers that give us excess product to redistribute. And we also, with the dollars that are donated to us, are able to buy truckloads of food at scale. So you may see that bag of rice, that 3-pound bag of rice for $2 at the grocery store, we may be able to get it for 19 cents, right? And so, I mean, we, because of the power of our network and working in 36 counties, we're able to bring things to scale with much smaller margins. We need, so that's on the food front. We need funds. So we need funds to continue doing our work, to be able to purchase a diverse grouping of food beyond what's just being donated to us, to keep the lights on, to drive our trucks, to refrigerate our coolers. So all of that helps with the operation. And we need friends. We need friends to advocate for the work that we do, not only being a voice and reaching out to elected officials when the time comes, but also to equip yourself and to know that this injustice is happening in our community, and for us to also move towards being a much more sovereign food system. And what I mean by that is not only when you have the opportunity to eat better for your own health and well-being to do that, but being more sensitive to food waste. As Americans, we often buy more than we need in excess, and a lot of our food goes to waste. And so think about those who don't have enough food to eat, how much food we throw away on a regular basis. And finally, being an advocate for food gleaning, there are policies that don't allow or do not encourage farmers to glean excess food. So it's almost more profitable for them to burn the food left in the fields, or to allow wild animals to eat the food, rather to glean the excess to come into food pantries or food banks to be redistributed to people who are in need.
So you would like to see some policies change that would alter some of those practices.
Absolutely.
You said something really interesting earlier about how for many people, now we're talking about people living in poverty who are living in the midst of food deserts where there is no full-service supermarket probably anywhere in their neighborhood, or certainly not close by. You said something about how in many cases people don't even realize that they're living in a food desert. I mean, if that desert is the only reality that they have ever known, if they've never been in a Sendix or something like that, I mean, or Whole Foods or something, a really, really fine establishment where anything and everything is available, they don't even know what they aren't experiencing, what they do not have. I'd never stopped to think about that. And in a sense, they are not likely to raise their voice about a problem that, in a sense, they might be, to some extent, completely unaware of.
I guess some communities may consider me a rebel rouser in that, you know, I didn't realize that people just didn't know what they just didn't know. But this has become a generational issue where, you know, I grew up on food stamps. I went to the corner store for our goods, and what they had were canned goods. And yeah, it smelled like roach spray, but they had loaves of bread, and like that's what we had. And that became the norm for them. And so from someone who's not a part, who doesn't swim in that water, we come into that knowing better. And we're like, you should be outraged. There was a partnership with the American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, the Medical College of Wisconsin, Milwaukee Public Schools. This whole consortium came together to do what we call citizen science groups, where we partnered with on a neighborhood level with local food pantries and residents to identify what was needed and what we identified as a local food desert. And oddly enough, we would have thought for sure they said, we need a grocery store here. But really what they said is that they want a more active community. Hmm. They want community gardens. We want us to work together to collaborate. And we're fine with the corner store. We just encourage them to get the foods that we'll actually buy from them. Hmm. So they were more in tune with social economics. And just imagine the waste if we had a grocer come in to build this gigantic grocery store where all they said is that we're minimalists. We want X, Y, and Z. If you provide it, we'll buy it.
Hmm. That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Because the other scenario points to somebody with well-meaning high ideals that might not actually be the most effective way to address a really serious problem. Mm-hmm. It is a really interesting array of issues that you are raising. And maybe another thing to just talk about briefly is when you are, in a sense, entering a community that is not directly your own, how does one shape this message? I mean, aside from this really intriguing thing you've done where you've written this fun children's book that really is aimed to children. But when it comes to the matter of also trying to move adults into thinking differently about their food and the choices they make, what are some of your guiding principles in how to do that most effectively?
Absolutely. As an urban planner and as a public health practitioner, I always go into a community. Yes, I do have my already always listening, kind of what I perceive and my knowing, but I go into communities first seeking to understand from their perspective because their reality guides what really is so. And so after I do my discovery phase and to learn what they identify as being the issues and some of the challenges and some of their desires, then I support them in identifying for themselves what the solutions are to address the problem. Because I can come in and say, oh, let me, with my bag of tricks and all my resources, and help you out. But on time and time again, what we see is that if it doesn't come from them as their idea, and if they're not excited about a mobilizing change, as soon as I leave from that community and come back to my own, it'll probably be worse than when I left it. I mean, from when I first engaged with them.
Right.
Raina, there's one problem that has occurred in Kenosha, in our community, within the last 2 years, I guess it is, and that is a very fine grocery store named The Brass, which is right next to the elementary school, closed. I don't know if it was suddenly, but it left a dearth in a whole section of the community that has not been addressed in either directly or indirectly, as far as I can tell. I do know that it was a bit of a jolt, I thought, to many people, including myself. We live not too far from it, but we have the means, obviously, to get to any store we want. However, I would, if you were an urban planner and saw that phenomenon taking place in a community like Kenosha, do you have anything that you would recommend in trying to either restore the store in some way or redistribute? I mean, the store is still standing there, still looks good, but it's empty.
There's no grocer operator. Mm-hmm. So as an urban planner, I would remind the constituents of this fine city that they have people power and that they have points of influence and they have levers that they can pull to be influencers in getting that grocery store back up and running, if not the original grocer, at least having something move into that space.
Yeah, that would be nice to see, because I know, and that was not all that long ago that this store went into this neighborhood, right. And it was maybe blithely assumed that this would be a lovely shot in the arm for a neighborhood that in some respects at least was struggling. And sadly, that particular story did not work out. And yes, it does, at least as far as I know, continue to stand empty.
I would say it also you definitely want to investigate why that grocery store isn't operating. You know, sometimes we have certain grocers go into communities that don't have the community in mind. You pop up and you don't carry the products. They're not culturally sensitive products. They're not the price point that the market will allow. So you've got to look at all of those things to find out what would be an appropriate outfit for this particular community.
Right. You're pointing to the fact that that some of these questions are complex questions, and their solutions are sometimes complex as well. And you're also suggesting that sometimes those solutions, in a sense, need to be born out of the community themselves and the people who live there.
I'm so glad that you mentioned, I love the word complex, because that's exactly how I describe hunger, in that people just don't wake up hungry one day, right? It's a system in which this happens. It's a system where either someone's not making enough money, or their health has gone downhill, or they don't have the education to get the job, to get the money, to get the food, to get the transportation. I mean, and so it's this whole complex issue of poverty that has to be addressed. And that's why I say it's going to take all hands on deck in our community to lay down our puzzle piece, specifically with the nonprofit, for-profit, and government sectors, to put our puzzle piece down, to talk about what role we play in really solving this dynamic issue of poverty, to truly come together to address how we're going to do this together.
One other issue I think we should touch on, at least briefly, is the fact that in many cases, when people eat and make their choices about what they're going to eat, those are choices that are sometimes made from a place of stress and anxiety. And of course, I think a lot of people are experiencing that right now. And eating, and sometimes eating excessive amounts of not good food, or food that is not good for them, out of a sense of trying to self-comfort, almost self-medicate in a sense. And this can lead people, of course, into making some really self-destructive choices. What would be your advice to people in terms of watching out for this really dangerous possibility?
Absolutely. I believe that food is medicine, and that we have to eat to live. And I think emotional eating is a real thing. And I think the biggest danger right up there with crack is sugar. And so sugar is highly addictive. You can find almost everything. That's why I'm a huge advocate for whole foods, like foods that you can actually see and touch, that don't have all these additives. Because when you get things in boxes and plastic bags that come in pouches, and if you read, probably the second or third ingredients is high fructose corn syrup or sugar. Sugar with all these different aliases. And sugar affects our brain. It affects our body. And when it affects our brain, it's directly connected to our mental health and well-being, and has direct connections to depression. And so when you look around and you see a bunch of overweight zombies, it's directly connected to the food that we eat. So that's why I'm a huge proponent that food is medicine, and a huge advocate for the healthy food movement. And I feel like when we start with Alex McGreen, The Tale of the Mysterious Kale, and our next generation's minds and eating habits are transformed, just imagine the beautiful, well thought of and considered legacy that we leave for our next generation.
If people listening to this conversation want to know more about your own nonprofit and the work that you're doing and what services they might access or make contributions to, what can they go to a website of some kind?
Absolutely. They can go to thehealthyfoodmovement.com. That's spelled out, just healthyfoodmovement.com. Right there you can purchase the book, Alex McGreen, The Tale of Mysterious Kale. It's also available on Amazon.
All right. And we trust that a lot of people have been given, let's say, good food for thought today on the choices that all of us can make in terms of the food that we eat, and that we can think about ways in which more people in our community can have access to the kind of good food that will make them healthier in every respect. Again, the book that we were talking about is Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale, and its author, Raina Andrews. Raina Andrews, it's been great to meet you today. I'm so glad you took time out of your schedule to join me today in our WGTD studios.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you so much, Howard, for the introduction.
Yes, Dr. Howard Moon, whose idea it was to bring Raina Andrews here, my thanks to you as well.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a memorable interview from The Morning Show archives with National Public Radio's Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition. The occasion of our conversation was the publication of his beautiful memoir called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, In Praise of Adoption. In the memoir, Scott Simon talks about the experience he and his wife had of adopting ultimately two beautiful baby girls from China. It was a process, however, that was not in any way simple. And there were a number of points along the way in which it looked like this might not actually happen. And we hear the full story on tomorrow's morning show. On Friday, you're going to be hearing from three organizers of the group Just Live, which over the last 10 years has been working hard to lift up the issue of suicide and suicide prevention. They have their major fundraiser coming up on Sunday, the 1st of September, the Labor of Love Music Festival. And the headliner for that group is going to be the bluegrass band Trampled by Turtles. And I have just recorded an interview with their mandolin player, Eric Berry, which I will be playing next week on the program. On Monday's morning show, you'll be hearing my conversation with Ronald C. Rossbottom, author of a fascinating book called Sudden Courage, Youth in France Confront the Germans, 1940 to 1945. It tells the fascinating story of how young people in France, in all kinds of different ways, courageously resisted the occupying Germans, the Nazis, who took control of France in 1940. It is a fascinating story, largely unknown to most of us. Next week as well, I look forward to conversations, I hope, with Art Sear from Carthage College, his monthly visit to the program. And I'm also going to be speaking with Doug and Kim Instanis about their memorable trip, which they just took to Edinburgh, Scotland, to see the Fringe Festival, one of the great theatrical events in all the world. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And you can hear The Morning Show actually 7 days a week if you subscribe to The Morning Show podcast. It's available on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. Make sure that you search for the program under the proper title, which is The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And again, you can hear not only the regularly broadcast morning shows from Monday through Friday, but also morning show offerings on Saturday and Sunday as well. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show.